equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog about the same theme. It's at the Vermont Commons website. That's vtcommons.org. And then you can type in /blog if you want, or just click on the link to the blog. There are a lot of bloggers there. My blog posts begin "Relocalizing Vermont" in the headline. We also post the audio from these shows on Monday and Tuesdays, my shows and Travin's. They're on equaltimeradio.com. I try to get mine up, don't always succeed, but try to get mine up by the end of the day on Tuesday. And there you can find links to information that the guests have brought up on the show, or find out more information about the guests. Got a great show coming up for you today. In the first half of the show, we're going to be talking about a new energy co-op that's formed in Addison County. We'll talk with a couple of the founders of the co-op, Laura Sermely and Greg Paul. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to talk to a Forbes magazine journalist who's come, Chris Steiner is his name, and he's come out with a new book called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. So we'll talk to him about why it's inevitable that gasoline will get up to $20 a gallon, when he thinks that's likely to happen, and why that will be for the better. But first, want to continue the tradition I started last week of starting out with a little discussion on healthcare, since that's an urgent national debate right now. There was a huge turnout at the Peacham Congregational Church last night for a good chicken dinner with a vegetarian entree as well, and discussions about healthcare. This was Bernie Sanders' town hall meeting there, and I think it's safe to say that Sanders was blown away by the attendance. With the church packed full upstairs and downstairs, and that's 450 people or so, according to what they were saying, and people still turned away, I expected Sanders to describe the crowd with his trademark, huge, a huge crowd. But he didn't. He did call the turnout in the small town unbelievable several times. And once, after running downstairs to answer some questions there, talk to the people, and then running back upstairs to the sanctuary, he muttered under his breath, "This is just weird." I'll play one of the stories that a speaker told last night in just a minute. First, I want to highlight again this week the fact that many of those opposed to health care reform are also opposed to Medicare. I filed a report from Peacham that Eric Michaels played during the noontime news, and one person interviewed in it was Sepier Barabee of St. Johnsbury. He wants to reduce regulation of private insurance companies and not have a public option. I didn't include the part of the interview where he said he wants to abolish Medicare and pretty much all the other federal spending other than defense. And Paul Beaudry on True North, last week I told you how amazed I was that he was playing Ronald Reagan's 1961 speech saying that if Medicare passed, the U.S. would become a totalitarian nation. Medicare is a really popular program. Reagan was wrong. By the time he ran for president in 1980, Reagan knew how wrong he'd been. During the campaign, he wouldn't admit to opposing Medicare. I wouldn't think that Paul Beaudry would be so interested in advertising what Reagan himself wanted us to forget. But Beaudry seems really to want to dismantle Medicare. In Thursday's show on the Constitution, he had an interesting discussion about the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And 200 years ago, at the founding of this country, that was an important discussion, and we can still learn from it. But Beaudry said at the time that there's an argument to be made that federal involvement in health care is unconstitutional. So Medicare, I guess, is unconstitutional, according to Paul Beaudry's argument, and the Veterans Administration, too, I suppose. Why do Beaudry and other opponents of health care reform want to take away your Medicare? I'm not sure, but I was pretty heartened to see that about three-quarters of the people who were there at the Congregational Church in Peacham yesterday were in favor of either single-payer, a lot of single-payer signs, a lot of single-payer stickers there, or at least a public option. Meanwhile, the U.S. is the only industrialized nation that doesn't have a national health care plan, and people are dying because of it. Even young people who may think that they don't need to pay for health insurance. Even young people with seemingly minor medical problems. Here's a story that Jen Henry told last night at the healthcare town hall in Peacham. Henry works as a nurse in Fletcher Allen. She's also the president of the nurses' union.
There's a story that I will keep with me for the rest of my life, and it happened probably 2 years ago. A young man came into the hospital, went to the emergency department because he had a small infection. And he needed a course of antibiotics, quick visit to the emergency.
Well, I'm sorry, we seem to have technical difficulties in playing Jen Henry's story, so I will paraphrase it for you. Sorry you don't get to hear it in her own words. It was about a young man that came into Fletcher Allen a couple of years ago, 20, 22 years old, and he had a small infection, easily treated with antibiotics. He had a job. The job did not provide health care for him, and apparently it wasn't a terribly high-paying job. He did not invest in health care coverage for himself, so he did what a bunch of people do when they really need health care. He went to the emergency room. He got his antibiotics. He took his course of antibiotics, and it seemed to cure him. But he got a huge bill for the emergency room. If anyone's ever been to the emergency room, you know that just walking in the door or being carried in the door there costs a lot of money. So it's a very expensive way to provide medicine. And Jen Henry said he was a diligent young man, wanted to pay that off. And then the infection recurred while he was trying to pay off that emergency room bill. Well, he figured, look, I'm still in debt for this last visit there. I don't want to go back and get some more antibiotics and go ask them to provide me with more service while I still haven't paid for what they did before. So he didn't go in for a while. And by the time he got in, then he needed to have disfiguring surgery on his face. It would have involved removing a bone that was so infected that it just couldn't stay in his body. And when they were taking him in for the surgery, he wasn't worried about the pain. He wasn't worried about the disfiguration. He was most worried, she said, about how he was going to pay for that. And then he didn't survive. It wasn't clear whether it was the surgery itself or shortly after the surgery. He died from this infection that was simple and treatable. So this is a story that led Jen Henry, nurse at Fletcher Allen, to say, look, people like this young man who are dead can't speak out about what happens with to them in the healthcare system. And it's her job, she says, and the job of other healthcare providers who witness them to go out and provide the larger witness. Yeah. We're going to keep stories like this coming on Equal Time. We do have a caller in response to this in Williamstown. Rama. Hello, Rama.
Good afternoon, Carl. Good to hear you. Hey, we're talking about Beaudry and the other Republicans and their anti-Medicare stance. And I just wanted to point out, coming out on the news today now, the Republicans down in D.C. have come out with an older people's Bill of Rights. Don't mess with Medicare, don't cut funding for Medicare, and don't reduce the older people's treatments under Medicare and keep them so they can go see the doctors that they want to see. In other words, you know, the Republicans have come out and said the exact same line that progressives have been saying for decades, while the Republicans have been sitting there saying, oh my God, Medicare is a horrible government program we need to do away with because it's driving us all broke. And now they're saying, my gosh, Medicare is a lovely program and we got to keep it going as it is. And I don't expect the Republicans to see either the irony or the humor in them coming out with that line now. But I see both, and not only do I find it ironic, I'm laughing my butt off at these clowns because they will stoop at nothing. No rhetorical twist is too dishonest for them not to stoop to.
Rama,
and that's all.
Rama, thanks for that perspective from Williamstown. Okay, so we're gonna keep stories like this coming on Equal Time and I'm gonna do them at the beginning of the shows. But right now we have other fish to fry, and if you want, maybe you can fry your fish on top of a wood pellet fired stove. Wood pellets are something that listeners in Addison County can now order through the newly formed Acorn Energy Co-op. ACORN stands for the Addison County Relocalization Network, and they've been preparing for energy scarcity for quite a few years. With us are two founders of the co-op. Laura Sermely, welcome to Equal Time.
Hello, I'm right here.
Okay, good to hear your voice. And Greg Paul, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, Greg Paul, can you, I was talking about frying fish on top of a wood pellet stove. Can you really do that?
No, I wouldn't recommend it.
No, okay. Well, I was just trying for a segue, and some segues are more forced than others. Anyway, Laura Sermely, will you tell us what this newly formed Acorn Energy Co-op does?
Certainly. Our mission is to make renewable energy and efficiency products and services available and affordable to our members. We're doing this, as you said, in response to an energy-constrained future. We're an offshoot of the Addison County Relocalization Network, and we're really working hard to transition the region. So we're trying to expand local fuel production to the extent that we can in the region, and one of those products are these new locally produced wood pellets. So they're harvested, the wood stock is harvested locally, it's manufactured locally, and it's distributed locally. That's the model that we want to support. So in addition to that, we've tried to find partners that can give discounts to our members on energy-related products and services. So let's say you're looking for an energy audit for your home, so we have a partner that would give a discount on his services for that. Or let's say that you're ready for solar, we have a partner that would give a discount on the system for that, in addition to what we now know as a federal incentive and other incentives for switching to renewables. And that's a lot of what we also do is help teach people what these incentives are and really get them started on renewable energy.
So this is a co-op. Why did you choose to use a co-op model rather than, say, a private company?
Greg, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. The general idea behind the co-op strategy is that it really helps to engage many members of the community in these projects. You know, a private company is, in some respects, perhaps a quicker and more efficient way to approach something like this. But by bringing in a wider range of members from the community, we feel that it encourages more and more people to get involved in our projects, to feel like they are partial owners of the project. And that generates a lot of grassroots enthusiasm and support for the work that we're doing. So we think it's a good model. It certainly has worked for natural foods co-ops. We have a very successful Middlebury Natural Foods Co-op here in Addison County. And we're following a somewhat similar model, except that we're dealing with energy instead of food.
And in your literature, you make that analogy that you say people are eating local, why not start heating local? And it makes me think when you talk about a co-op of not only the food co-op that you mentioned, but also community-supported agriculture, where people pay for a share of a farm's harvest, and then they become interested in the farm in numerous senses of the word, and often are invited out to the farm to help out with some of the farm work. But by making this a co-op, by having people buy into it, do you expect to have people come out and help with some part of growing the wood for the wood pellets or processing it?
I think there are a number of different ways where the owner members of the co-op will become involved in one or another of the various projects that we are or will be involved in. So I think it's that direct participation by our member owners that we feel is really important. And there's been an awful lot of enthusiastic response from Addison County residents, and in fact from surrounding counties as well. We've already expanded the focus of our work to Chittenden and Rutland counties as well, because there's been so much interest expressed there too.
Wow, how many members do you have?
At the moment, I think we've got about 72 members, and that number keeps growing all the time. We're very excited about the response.
And when did you open your doors for membership?
Well, officially, it was earlier this year. We've been up and more or less running since last year. We were legally formed in June of 2008, and we did run an experimental pre-buy and bulk delivery for wood pellets last fall to see how that process would work. We brought in 66 tons of pellets from Georgia, actually, and we learned a lot from that experience, and we're now decided to go forward with that on a much more organized basis. based on local fuel rather than out-of-state fuel. We think that's a really important part of this, to keep our energy dollars circulating within the local economy rather than sending it out of state the way we normally do with most fossil fuel products.
So a lot of money that we send out of state. I calculated just back of the envelope calculation. Well, it was a 2 or 3 hour back of the envelope calculation, but I calculated that in 2008 we sent approximately $1.3 billion out of state to pay for heating here in Vermont. So
I think that sounds about right.
Yeah, if you capture a small fraction of that, then it helps out the Vermont economy quite a bit.
That's right.
So how many tons of Vermont-made pellets are you prepared to sell this year?
Well, this mill that we're working with is Vermont Wood Pellet Company, and they're down in North Clarendon, Vermont. And when the mill is fully operational, up and running, full steam, they're supposed to be able to turn out approximately 10,000 tons per year.
Wow.
And that's more than enough to supply our current customers.
Right. Do you have an exclusive contract with them, or?
It's a three-way arrangement between them and Bordeaux Brothers in Middlebury, who's a local feed dealer. They'll be doing all the deliveries in any case, and then the co-op as well.
Hmm.
Yes.
Hmm. So that feed dealers, they're used to dealing with pellets.
They're very used to dealing with all kinds of bulk commodities. They're good at it, and that's why we've made this arrangement.
Right.
So each of the partners brings some particular strengths to the partnership.
Even if the feed dealers maybe haven't dealt with wood pellets before, then a lot of the feed comes formulated in pellets.
Yeah, they know how to handle bulk commodities.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Carl Etner. You're listening to Equal Time. Our guests right now are Greg Paul, we've just been talking with, and Laura Sirmily. They are founders of the new Acorn Energy Co-op. And Laura, why don't you tell us, besides the pellets being locally produced, what are the advantages of buying your energy through the co-op?
Well, you are enabling us to make capital investments in other projects. You're also enabling us to do the education and outreach to the community on why it's important to kick the oil habit and switch to renewables. And you're also enabling us to start up what we hope to be a very exciting program, the Home Site Renewable Energy Assessment Program, where we're able to go to a home site and look at the site and give you a holistic report on what you're suited for, given a range of criteria, from your age to the orientation of your home to your budget, you know, to a number of factors. So that's what the membership would support.
Hmm. How are these different from usual energy audits, these audits that you were just talking about, Laura?
Well, we're assuming that the homeowner would have already gotten an energy audit. In fact, we will encourage it, you know, as a first step. So we're not going to duplicate that service, which is already provided. So, and we're not duplicating what, say, a solar store would do in terms of looking at your site for just solar. We're more broad-based and holistic in terms of looking at the home site and be able to just talk to the homeowner about steps that they should take in prioritizing their work.
Hmm. Have you done
an energy auditor? An energy auditor will just go in and look at the air leaks in the home and recommend weatherizing to button up the home.
Yep.
So, I mean, we would be able to go in a home and we could probably tell, oh, they probably didn't get it done based on some evidence. So we would then refer them to where they could get those services. And then if they're a member of the co-op, they could get a discount from partners that are providing those services.
Hmm. So have you done one of these beyond audits, meta audits, or whatever you want to call it yet?
No, that's still, we're in development. We're just designing that right now.
That sounds like a fascinating program. Do you have models that you're basing that on from elsewhere
in
the country?
Could I jump in here?
Please do, Greg Paul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The concept for this service is relatively new. There's virtually no one in the country that's doing it. You can get bits and pieces of this from people who are going into, you know, to button up your home and make it more efficient. That's one very important piece. If you're talking to, say, a solar contractor or a wind installer, they'll do their part of it. They'll come to your home, look at it, and tell you whether or not the system really makes sense and how much it might cost. But there's virtually no one out there who does a comprehensive survey of your entire home, your entire site, all of the factors that might come to bear on whether a renewable energy strategy of one kind or another, you know, might make sense. And there might be a variety of different strategies that might make sense. And so what we're hoping to provide is this unique, as Laura described, as kind of a holistic, overall, big picture view of you, your home, your site, and how all of that might come into play to maximize your ability to harvest locally available energy resources.
Hmm. And why don't you give us the website for the Energy Co-op?
Sure. It's www.acornenergycoop.com.
And there's no hyphen in that?
Nope.
Okay. Well, we had a guest on our show, maybe 9-12 months ago, David Eggleston from Massachusetts, who was talking about energy coaching. He's an energy expert, a home energy expert, and he was saying, you know, how athletes really increase their performance when they get regular feedback from a coach. People trying to save energy in their homes are better served if they don't just get a one-time audit, and he might say, no matter how holistic and broad-based it is, but if they get continuous feedback from somebody who comes in and talks with them about, you know, how they're arranging their life, that or how far they've come in installing various hardware, would this be a part of the work that you're thinking of doing?
I would think so. Yeah, I mean, this would be a really major reason to join the co-op in the first place, because as a group of people, we will be working together amongst ourselves to continually educate ourselves on the various strategies and programs and incentives and so on that might be available at any given time.
Hmm.
You know, we view ourselves as a provider of information as much as anything.
Hmm.
Certainly, the bulk purchasing of various energy sources or fuels is a major part of our mission and our role, but it's this continual flow of information back and forth between the co-op and its members. I think that's one of the real major advantages of becoming a member in the first place.
Hmm.
This is certainly an ongoing process.
And I'll just jump.
Please,
yes,
please
and that's where we do make a concerted effort to try to get to events and out in the community as much as possible so that people can tell us, you know, their ideas and we can respond to their questions related to energy and coach them. It's exactly the way that it happens.
Mm.
And in fact, another thing that we provide is the ability to go to a group, either in a company or a small group, and do a renewable energy talk with them.
Will your services be available to members only of the co-op or also to non-members?
Our primary focus, of course, is on our membership. We are there to serve our members, and the co-op is the membership. But I think in general, the community would be able to avail themselves of a lot of general information. All they have to do is go to the website, for that matter. That's a lot of information right there. That's free to anybody.
Right. And to become a member... go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to say the website is an incredible resource, and people have told us that once people have a chance to visit the website, they see the depth of information that they can get, especially on the resources button.
And that website is acornenergycoop.com. You'll be able to find that at our website, equaltimeradio.com, when I get the audio up from this as well. It costs, depending on your income level, $250 or $350 for a member equity share, I see. You can pay off at $25 or $35 per year. What other sources of capital have you used for the co-op?
We've had a few very small grants and quite a few community donations. They're pleasantly surprised. When we first started setting this up, people just sent money. They wanted to be helpful. They just wanted to participate. And we can certainly always use more.
Hmm. And you can get that address through the website as well.
You can contact us through the website. And in fact, we do have a member loan program, which is part of the financial picture. We certainly are encouraging and soliciting loans from our own members to help us get over the first few years of operation, which are always the toughest.
Well, help me understand how this all fits together with a partnership program. I understand how everything you've been talking about so far connects with your energy-related mission, but then I see amongst your community partners are some restaurants, there's a shoe store, an office services store, a wine and liquor store. How do they fit in?
Well, we have been very pleasantly surprised at the broad base of support that we've received from the community and the business community in particular. We certainly won't turn anybody down who wants to be helpful. The energy part certainly is our primary focus. On the other hand, the wider range of discounts and other benefits of membership that we can offer certainly makes becoming a co-op member that much more attractive. But we still are primarily focused on the energy and energy product and related services sector.
Well, to find out how to save money on your energy and get it locally and renewable, or how to get an 11% discount on three or more bottles of wine, go to acornenergycoop.com. Laura Sermely and Greg Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Carl.
And coming up in just a minute, we're going to be talking with Forbes magazine journalist Chris Steiner. Christopher Steiner is the author of $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. We'll find out from him why $20 per gallon is inevitable, when we're likely to see it, and how it will change our lives for the better. I'm Carl Etner. You're listening to Equal Time. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etner, and in the last half of this show, we're going to be talking with Christopher Steiner, the author of $20 per Gallon. One of the main themes of this show is that we're facing less energy and much more expensive energy in the near future, and that the consequences for our society of this are mind-boggling. We've talked with people who have a rather dismal view of the future with significantly less oil for us to use, and also people who see a strong upside to it. Today, talking with Chris Steiner, we'll find out why he sees quite a few upsides to $20 a gallon gasoline. Steiner is a journalist for Forbes magazine and the author of $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. If you're thinking about whether to replace your oil heater with a wood pellet heater, so you can buy some of these locally produced wood pellets from Addison County we were just talking about, or something else local and renewable, or really if you're thinking about any investment, Steiner's book is a good one to read. He's made a systematic study of the consequences of increasing gasoline prices and tells what's likely to happen to our world with $6 a gallon gas, $8 a gallon, $10 a gallon, and so on, up to 20. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you begin by telling us why $20 a gallon gas is inevitable and when you think it might come to pass?
Well, it sounds like your listeners are pretty familiar with the raw ideas behind peak oil. So I won't delve into that too far, but just to touch on them quickly.
We may have some new listeners today.
Okay, well, right now, there are a billion people on the earth living what we call American-style lives. By 2040, most estimates have that number closer to 3 billion. So between now and 2040, you're going to triple the number of people living middle-class lifestyles, just like us. Those people are going to want oil. The problem is that right now we're at about 84 million barrels per day. That's the amount of oil our Earth produces, or the amount we're able to pull out of it per day. And most people think that this is basically it. This is the highest we're ever going to see. We're actually down a couple billion barrels from where we were a few years ago. And as some of these giant fields in places like Saudi Arabia and Mexico start to go into decline, and a lot of them are already there, the amount of oil we produce every day is going to become less and less. Now, it's going to be a slow decrease. That's the good news. But right when we need more oil for all these added middle-class members across the globe in places like India and China, we're actually going to have less oil. So what happens when supply goes down, demand goes up, price goes up? And that will then mitigate people's use. And in mitigating how we use oil, our lives will change. You won't drive as much. You won't fly as much. You won't live as far away from the places you have to go. So some of these changes are going to be good. Some are going to be painful.
Mm. And let's talk about the changes that we've already seen. You begin with a chapter on $4 a gallon gasoline.
Right. And, you know, I think last year was quite an awakening for a lot of Americans. You know, I don't think Europe was nearly as bothered by last summer as we were, just because when you're paying $8 a gallon and it goes up to $10 a gallon, well, that's a pain in the butt. But it's not like going from 2 to 4, which is basically what we did. And when you look at what happened over the last, say, 6 or 7 years, since we went from roughly $1.20, $1.30 a gallon all the way to four was really the tipping point for Americans. They really almost didn't pay attention until we got there. Now, you know, I remember when gas got to $2 back in 2001 or 2002, and I remember thinking that was a really big deal. But in fact, it wasn't a big deal at all. People drove more every year. Every year, year after year, Americans drive more. They drive more. You know, they drive more miles. And then came last year. Now, if you recall, you couldn't buy a Prius or anything close to sticker. You couldn't sell your SUV for 20 cents on the dollar. And in addition to that, Americans drove 100 billion less miles in 2008 than they did in 2007. We've never had a drop like that. That was a clear response to the high price of gasoline. So, you know, Americans didn't react like that to $2 gas. They didn't react like that to $3 gas. So that was a tipping point for how we drive. And the impetus for the book was, well, what other tipping points are out there beyond $4 a gallon? If we go beyond that, what else, what other paradigms get pulled down by the price of gasoline?
And we were talking about healthcare at the beginning of this show. One of the things that you point out is driving 100 billion miles less in 1 year meant that fewer people were killed and maimed by cars.
Very much so. Usually we lose over 45,000 people a year on our roads. There is a professor at Harvard, David Grabowski, who has a study that's I talk about in the book. For every $1 rise in the price of gasoline, we save about 6,000 lives on the road. So it's $6 gas, we'll save 16,000 people. It's $10 gas, we save almost half the number of people that would have died on the roads, those 45,000. Those people are spared, and that's because, A, there's less people on the roads, clearly, but, B, people tend to drive slower, and they tend to drive less frivolously than they do when gas is cheap.
Hmm. So $10 a gallon gasoline means about 23,000 lives saved in the U.S.
That's right. In addition to that, staying on the healthcare beat, the America's obesity level, as most people know, has doubled since 1978 to more than 30% of the adult population. Now, there's a study that just came out from the University of British Columbia linking urban sprawl, suburban sprawl, and obesity. You know, saying that these two things are very connected, and urban sprawl helps cause obesity. In addition to that fact, there's a study that I talked about in my book by a professor at the University of North Carolina, Charles Cordemanche, who says that a $1 rise in the price of gas actually means a decrease in our obesity rate of 10%. That's in America. And for every dollar the price of gas goes up, we save 11,000 lives that we would have lost to obesity-related diseases. That's for a sustained increase in the price of gas. In addition to that fact, we save $11 billion in health costs for every dollar the price of gas goes up that we would have spent trying to prevent and treating these obesity-related diseases. So there are some strange side effects you wouldn't normally think of with the rise in the price of gas.
Hmm. And on the other hand, we had on this show, 6 or 8 weeks ago, Jeff Rubin. He's a Canadian economist, the author of Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. And in that book, he argues, and I don't know how convincing it is to someone better trained in economics than I am, but he argues that the last year's high price of gasoline and heating oil and other things energy related and all the side effects of it was enough to push the world into the recession that some people are calling the Great Recession right now. So, you know, what's going to happen to the overall economy as gas prices ratchet up like this?
Well, Jeff Rubin definitely has a point in regards to the price of oil. Certainly, higher prices of oil don't enable the kind of economic growth that lower prices of oil do. But it's important to remember that we kept on growing the economy as gas went from $1 to $2 to $3. That was a tripling in the price of gasoline, yet it didn't send us into a recession. So from 3 to 4 apparently did. I do think the price of gas helped the recession take extra hold, but there were so many things lined up against us in the housing world that was the real impetus, and the price of oil just made things worse. I don't think it's what actually sent us into the recession. But it didn't help. There's no doubt about it.
I've also read very convincing analyses of the recession saying that it all has to do with the rising of consumer debt and the adjustable rate mortgages and that whole package. So
exactly.
I don't know what the cause is. However, all of the spikes in oil prices in the last, 40 years have been followed by recessions in this country.
Yes, and our economic growth is tied to oil. There's no doubt about it. And the way we're going to get off of that pattern as we go forward here, let's say in 2 years the world economy is recovered, and let's say gas gets up to $5 a gallon. Well, that will create demand destruction. People who were using gas to do this or do that or make money in their business will stop doing it because it become too expensive, and that will lead to economic not growth, but actually stagnation. And at that point, the price of gas will probably go back down a little bit. But, at these higher prices, what happens is new technologies and new ways of thinking come into the mainstream. And if we want to continue to grow our economy in the coming decades, we will have to figure out how to do what we do now using less oil. It's very simple. And I think we will figure that out. I mean, it's a capitalist society. It's a capitalist system. There's always going to be somebody figuring out a way to do what we do now with less oil. And when they do that, it'll enable more growth with higher oil prices. Now, will the price of oil lead to recessions as it goes up? Probably. I don't think any of them will be as bad as the current recession we're seeing, unless we have, other factors that we have relating to it now. But I do think you'll see kind of a yo-yo with the price of gas. Say we touch new heights, it'll create demand destruction that sends the price of gas back down. But I think each time we set off a new height, it'll bring new technologies and methods into the marketplace that will then enable us to continue growing at higher and higher gas prices.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Carl Ettenayer, the Monday host for Equal Time Radio. And our guest today is Christopher Steiner. He's the author of $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. If you'd like to join the conversation, the local number is 244-1777. Or you can call us toll-free, 877-291-8255. I mean, there's a lot to be said, Christopher Steiner, for the miraculous working of the invisible hand in the market and causing demand destruction when oil prices, energy prices go up. And there are a lot of people with innovative ideas, like the people we were just talking about with in the first half of the show, producing local wood pellets for heating buildings. On the other hand, one of the things that we've seen in the last year is that sometimes capital markets just freeze up when there's a recession. And how are we going to know that the capital is going to be available there to make these huge investments for the transition?
Well, we haven't seen the type of capital freeze that we've seen over the last 9 months ever really before, going back 60 or 70 years. So I'd like to say that, that won't happen. Well, do I know for sure? No. And, my book isn't on capital markets. It's on, the different tipping points that are out there for the price of gasoline.
Mm.
So I can't answer that question. Okay. I do think that we just saw an extraordinary amount of things come together, especially the amount of paper that these large banks had in mortgage-backed assets that led to a lot of the credit freezing that we saw. That had really nothing to do with the price of energy in this case.
Fair enough. Well, let's go back to the scenarios that you spin out in $20 per gallon, some of the fascinating scenarios. Ratchet it up $2 to $6 a gallon, it's the death of the SUV.
Right. You know, and you know, we already saw last summer what happened when gas got to $4. And I think at $6, you're just going to see a lot of those same trends continue. Americans are going to proactively search out cars that get better fuel mileage. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, when you look at a J.D. Power survey of what matters most to car buyers, fuel economy, I believe, was number 5 or number 6. It's now number 1 or number 2. And last summer, it was by far number 1.
Mm.
And it will remain number 1 in the future going forward. And I think that's something we should get used to. And, you know, when the SUVs comes off the road for the normal American, it also saves a lot of lives because those are just inherently dangerous cars. Not because they're so big, but, I mean, that is a problem because they inflict a lot of damage when they hit something, but because they're so hard to maneuver. That, you know, SUVs, you see something happen in front of you, and you go to crank the wheel to the right or the left, more often than not, you're going to flip the SUV, whereas a sedan's not going to flip. So there's good sides to this, too. And, I mean, I think a lot of people enjoy driving SUVs, but we didn't always have them, and we won't always have them, so I think we'll get used to that.
That was fascinating research that you reported on, that SUVs are not only more dangerous to other people on the road, which is sort of intuitive, but they're also more dangerous per million vehicles than small cars to the drivers inside of them.
Exactly, because they make accidents all by themselves when you tilt the wheel to the left or the right.
Hmm. And then let's ratchet it up to $8 a gallon. And I just love this this phrase and heading, the airline dinosaurs meet their asteroid of death, $8 per gallon gasoline.
Yeah, and, you know, we may see some of the airlines go under before then if the government doesn't bail them out because they're in such bad straits during these economic times of crisis right now. But when you look at these airline networks like Americans and Uniteds and Deltas and Northwests across North America, these were built out with the assumption that jet fuel would make up 10 to 15% of operating costs. Well, here we are now, and last summer at $4 per gallon gas, those airlines are spending about 40% of their operational budgets on jet fuel. When we get to $8, you're talking about 60 to 70% of operational costs are going to be going to jet fuel. That's simply, you know, it can't go on. It won't go on. And most of these airlines will fail. I think we'll still have airlines. Probably JetBlue and Southwest will remain, and they will take over the skies. But flying coast to coast will be $1,000. It won't be $300. People who need to do it will be able to do it. But it won't be like now where, you know, right now I fly to the West Coast. It's almost like jumping in a cab. It's very affordable for a lot of people. We'll still fly in the future, but it just won't be something that we do as often.
Hmm. Right after Hurricane Katrina, which took out a lot of the oil production in the Gulf of Mexico, I was telling people as gas went up towards $3 and then surpassed $3 a gallon, I was saying, I think we're going to see a couple more major airlines go bankrupt by the end of the year. And
right.
I didn't know anything about airlines and their economies except that they use a lot of fuel and they tend to go bankrupt. And it took 2 weeks to have two major airlines go bankrupt then.
They use a lot of fuel and they tend to go bankrupt. You could sum up the whole industry right there. That pretty much does it.
Let's jump up to $12 a gallon and look at what happens with urban revolution and suburban decay.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the more interesting stories of our future. When you talk about cities like Detroit, cities like Pittsburgh, cities like St. Louis, these are places that have lost more than 50% of their population since 1955 or so. But the thing is, the infrastructure in a lot of these places, when I say that, I mean the bridges, the big buildings, the street grids, those things remain, and they'll get used again. I honestly believe that Detroit will recover in a future of higher energy costs. People will move back in and revitalize that city because it's a whole lot easier to move back into Detroit and use that infrastructure that's there to live densely than to build a brand new Detroit somewhere else. And I think $12 is kind of the point of no return for a lot of people who are out in these bigger homes 20, 30 miles outside the city, sometimes even further than that. When you talk about Chicago, where I live, you know, you have exurbs 50, 60 miles outside the city, and those, for the most part, are less than 10 years old. They're not well-built houses, but they are giant, and these people usually have half-acre of land. Those places are not going to be where people want to be in the future. And you've already seen that to some degree over the last 2 years. The places that have crashed the hardest during the real estate bust and have remained down the furthest are these places like and the edges of Riverside, California, outside Los Angeles, or 60 miles outside Chicago. Those types of places are not going to survive in the future, and they'll probably end up going straight back to farms.
Hmm. Well, we're seeing some urban areas, like parts of Detroit, like Flint, Michigan, where they're going back to miniature farms in the cities, where the city is purchasing up houses in foreclosure, I believe, and to complete the emptying of blocks and then building parks, or they could be used for farming there. Rather than having Detroit recover to the population size that it had at its height, which I think is twice as much as it has right now, how much sense would it make to just use that land for locally produced food to feed the people who are remaining?
I think you'll see that happen, definitely in places where the land's available and cheap. I think the problem is that eventually the land, just like anything else, is worth more with someone living on it than producing food. But then, see, the food ends up being produced in the old exurbs, and then we can bring it in cheaply on rail systems or via rivers or things like that. And right now, when we talk about close-by farms, we're talking about produce, of course. And most of the produce that I say buy in a supermarket here in Chicago comes from anywhere but close to here. When I buy apples, even in the middle of summer, even in fall, when you think we'd be getting all these apples from nearby orchards, because there's a lot of orchards close by in Michigan and Wisconsin, the apples are from New Zealand, or they're from Washington State, or they're even from Japan and Australia. And that's because, for some reason, Albertsons or Safeway has figured out a way to make an apple from New Zealand cheaper than an apple in Southwest Michigan, which is just an hour and a half away from here. But that's because of cheap oil. Without cheap oil, that relationship doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. In the future, I'll buy an apple from Southwest Michigan if I'm in a supermarket or a market in Chicago. And likewise, in Chapter 16, we talk about the food web and how many crazy things there are like that. You know, for instance, you have Norwegian salmon fishermen who catch these things, put them on ice, and then they send them in a plane to China, where they're then gutted and cleaned. And then they get sent back to Norway, and they sit on Norwegian supermarket shelves packaged as local fresh salmon. And it is local, but it also went to China in between getting caught and coming back to your plate. So some of these bizarre things that we see in the world of food, they'll cease to exist, and we will see more local food. Farms producing produce will kind of ring some of the larger metro areas, I think. And there's a great description of a farmer outside Chicago. His name's Tim Fuller, and I spent a couple days with him out at his farm, and he's actually an MBA from the University of Chicago, and he used to teach business school down there. And at some point, he's kind of semi-retired now, and he opened up an organic farm, and he kind of painted a picture for me of what it takes to move food around the country in the type of price per in oil terms that it'll take to get local food to become king again.
Well, one of the things we saw here in Vermont last year was that a lot of people facing $4 a gallon gasoline and heating, 60% of the homes in Vermont being heated by oil, a lot of the rest by propane, natural gas. People were starting to choose between putting food on the table and keeping warm in the winter. And it was only because oil prices came down so fast and we got some extra home heating assistance from the federal government that we avoided a big emergency here. How much suffering do you see happening as gasoline prices ratchet up?
Well, there's definitely going to be suffering. I mean, and you talk about heating oil in the Northeast, it's a problem. And it's a problem that, seems to come back every couple of years out there. And, I mean, I would not be surprised to see much of the region over the next 20, 30 years convert to natural gas, just because most of the natural gas we use comes from this continent. And we just had a couple big finds within this own country. Now, will natural gas be cheap forever? No, it won't. Certainly not. It's just another fossil fuel. It's a finite resource. But, in the short term, meaning the next 2 to 3 decades, I think it'll be a lot easier and cheaper to heat your house with natural gas rather than foreign oil. But beyond that, I think the kind of places we live are going to change indelibly. Whereas the average family now lives in a 2,500-square-foot house, and that's up from 1,600 square feet just in the late 1970s. An amazing increase. And that increase is largely due to the price of oil. You know, people, you know, you talk about all the new homes that have built since, been built since the 70s. It's insane. And there's the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech University estimates that by 2025, we're going to have an excess of 22 million large lot homes in America.
Wow.
So we already have too many of these things out there.
Christopher Steiner is the author of $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. So he also sees a silver lining to much of this. You can get his book at locally owned independent bookstores everywhere, and you can also read it to find out what's likely to happen to the University of Vermont, which brings in a lot of out-of-state students when oil prices rise. Chris Steiner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And the peak oil and rising energy prices are yet another reason to go to acornenergycoop.com and sign up for your locally produced wood pellets that we talked about in the first part of the show. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for today's Equal Time. And I'll be back next week with, I'll be on vacation, but I'll send in greatest hits or something like that. Travin will be in tomorrow. And Jack Donovan produced the show along with Frankie Allen. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
At age 46, I just bought my first motorcycle. A little 125cc scooter, bigger and faster than a moped, but not by much. The EPA rated mileage is 96 miles per gallon, so I'm hoping in the real hilly world of Vermont, I'll get at least 80. One big question in my mind is, will the scooter help me save fuel? No question that the scooter is more fuel efficient than the cars I have access to. One car gets 30 to 35 miles per gallon, the other 50 to 60. But a lot of my local transportation is by bicycle or by carpooling. I decided to invest in a motorcycle a couple weeks ago after bicycling to the county fair and back. It's about 25 miles away, and because the normal bridge was out, my route took me over more hills than normal. I got home around 11 that Friday night. I'd intended to go back on Saturday, both to visit the fair again and to try the yak meat samples that a friend was offering at the nearby farmer's market. But when I woke up on Saturday and contemplated spending all that additional time on a bicycle, I decided not to. I love cycling, but I was looking at spending 5 hours of my day pedaling. A 5-hour bicycle trip can be fun as a lark, but it feels like a chore when it's just getting from point A to point B and back again. I suppose I could have just adjusted my attitude and told myself how lucky I was to get a beautiful long summer bicycle ride in the Green Mountains of Vermont as a side benefit of going to the fair. After all, people come from all over and pay good money to bicycle tour in Vermont. But that attitude wouldn't have won me any more time to tend the garden, stack firewood, or do any of the other chores waiting at home. I skipped the fair that day and went motorcycle shopping instead. I stopped by a couple local dealers, checked out Craigslist, and read some on the web about various models. I wasn't sure whether I wanted a moped or a small motorcycle. In Vermont, anything with an engine size bigger than 50cc is a motorcycle, and it requires a special motorcycle learner's permit or license. Coming at this from a bicyclist's perspective, I thought a 49cc motor was incredibly powerful, so a moped would suit me fine. The motorcycle dealers in the area didn't have mopeds in stock, and the first used moped I looked at had a frozen rear brake, a leaky fuel system, a leaky exhaust pipe, and needed a tune-up. I wanted my first machine to be one that I spent more time riding than tinkering with, so I passed on it. I bought a low-mileage, used 125cc scooter on Tuesday, got my learner's permit on Friday, and now I feel ready to pass the skills test for the full motorcycle license. I can see some occasions where the scooter will save fuel, like when I get pressed for time and don't leave enough leeway to bicycle the 11 or 16 miles to the radio station. In the past, I drove. In the future, at least when the roads aren't icy, I'll probably ride the scooter. On the other hand, Jevons' paradox of efficiency applies to me, too. Jevons' paradox says that as a process becomes more efficient, people tend to gobble up any efficiency gains by doing more of that process. For example, fuel efficiency increased in cars after the oil price shocks of the 1970s, yet driving went up enough to increase total gasoline use. Yesterday, I rode over 40 miles on the motorcycle, probably using half a gallon of gas, to get to events that I could not have fit in with just a bicycle. Driving would have used at least twice that much gas. On the other hand, before I had the motorcycle, I would not have driven, probably. I would have skipped one of those events and used the bus and maybe carpooling to shorten my total bicycle ride to less than 25 miles, using no gas. There's also the embedded energy of the motorcycle. It took a lot of energy to manufacture the scooter and ship it to the dealer. If I do reduce fuel consumption with the scooter, it will still be a while before the savings offset the amount of energy used to make the thing. Still, scooter's fun to ride. I look forward to seeing how it affects my total fuel use. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In. And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGBR Bainford.